Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Scott Sweat is with us. Scott is the author, along with Tim Ziegler, of a new book, To Set the Record Straight, How Swift Boat Veterans, POWs, and the New Media Defeated John Kerry. Scott, to setterecordstraight.com, by the way, the website. Scott, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
First of all, who's I have the book here in my hand. Whose picture is this on the cover?
That would be John O'Neill. He was the lead spokesman of the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth.
I thought it was. I thought he looked familiar. He's been on this program several times. First of all, why revisit this?
Well, it isn't exactly a matter of revisiting it. We felt that the inside story of what happened in 2004 from the perspective of the veterans who opposed John Kerry had never been told, and that an accurate account of it was therefore a useful thing.
How do you respond to John McCain, the Republican senator, who says, I think the ad is dishonest and dishonorable, as it is none of those individuals who served on the boat that Kerry commanded. Many of his crewmates have testified to his courage under fire. I think John Kerry served honorably in Vietnam.
I think I would cite Admiral Hoffman, who is the leader of the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, who said that...
He was on the boat with John Kerry?
He actually commanded the entire effort that John Kerry was a part of.
But he was not on the boat with John Kerry?
No, the people that command things usually aren't on six-person boats.
Did you have any of the people who were on the boat with John Kerry in any of these ads?
Yes, certainly. Steve Gardner was the gunner for John Kerry, who served with him longer than any other crewman on his boat. He's the guy that came forward to say that Kerry's claim to have fought the Khmer Rouge while ordered illegally into Cambodia was not true.
That he was off by a couple of weeks in his recollection.
But I was responding to your comment about McCain. Admiral Hoffman said that he certainly respected McCain's service and his opinion, but that McCain wasn't there and that the Swift Vets had a number of eyewitnesses who were.
Yeah. T. Boone Pickens has offered $1 million to anyone who can disprove your claims. John Kerry has taken him up on his offer. Now he's backpedaling. Why?
Well, I don't know if to what extent he's backpedaling. Kerry did say that he had new evidence that was going to confirm his version of the various events that the Swift Boat Veterans disputed. I haven't seen that evidence, and I don't think anyone else has either.
Well, I have his letter here. It doesn't say anything about new evidence. He says, as I've said to you before, I'm prepared to prove the lie and marshal all the evidence. The question is whether you're prepared to fulfill your obligation. I mean, I have his entire letter here. I don't see new evidence anywhere in it.
Well, what?
Dear Mr. Pickens, I mean, it's nine paragraphs. I could read the whole thing to you, but I'm sure you've got it.
Well, what Pickens said was that if any of the core contentions that the Swift Boat Veterans made in their TV ads against Kerry could be proven untrue, he would give $1 million to anybody that could do that. To disprove something, you normally have to provide evidence. Kerry hasn't provided any.
We're talking with Scott Sweat, the author of a new book, To Set the Record Straight, How the Swift Boat Veterans, POWs, and the New Media Defeated John Kerry. Scott, let's talk about strategy for a second here. Much of the book is historical and detailing, you know, all the terrible things about John Kerry. But the subtitle, How the Swift Boat Veterans and the New Media Defeated John Kerry, is something that intrigues me. George W. Bush... arguably was a deserter, somebody who, you know, under law could have been executed. If you're AOL for more than 30 days, you're a deserter. And he went AWOL for well over 30 days.
You're suggesting George Bush should have been executed?
I'm suggesting that George Bush committed a crime that at various times in the history of this country has resulted in execution.
You know, that seems like a rather stretched perspective on his service.
Here's my question. I'm not asking you to agree or disagree with me on it. I think it's a matter of record that George Bush was AWOL for more than 30 days. But if I was a Democrat and I was running...
Hypothetically.
Yeah, this is entirely hypothetical. I'm just asking your advice, because you guys did this very effectively. I mean, I agree with you. You guys helped bring down John Kerry badly, and I don't mean that you did it badly. You did it brilliantly, but it brought him down very badly, and his failure to respond to it, I think, was a stupid disaster. If I decided, if I was John Kerry, for example, and I was running against George Bush, or I was running, or if I was advising a presidential campaign now, and we had somebody like George Bush who had such a clear violation, I mean, a guy who was AWOL for you know, nearly a year from the military, running against somebody who actually volunteered to serve, how would I most effectively swift boat George W. Bush?
Well, the CBS News 60 Minutes made a serious effort to do exactly that, and the reason it didn't work was because the documents on which the claims were based were forgeries. So I think one key element...
I don't think that's been demonstrated. I think that's still an open question.
I think it's crystal clear they were done on a word processor. There weren't word processors in 1969.
Well, again, there were computers that did have some of those characters. I mean, nonetheless,
the point I was going to make was that a key element of successfully, if you want to use the term swift voting a political candidate,
sure,
from my perspective, is you have to be able and willing to back up your claims with documented evidence, which the swift vote veterans did. When they put their first ad forward, they had 60 pages of documentation that they gave to the TV station managers. They knew if they had an ad pulled off the air, it would be a disaster. And each of the 20 stations that they submitted the information to did run the ads.
Clearly, you think that personal attacks like this about somebody's history, you know, 30 years before the fact, is an important statement of their character in the campaign.
Well, I would go with a little wider gauge than that. What the swift vote veteran said was that Kerry had systematically falsified his claims about what he did in Vietnam, and obviously character is a key component of politics.
So why do you think that the Democrats never brought up George Bush's cocaine use, his alcoholism, his alleged wife beating, his being AWOL, for example?
Wife beating, no kidding.
Yeah, I mean there were allegations that and fairly well substantiated ones, I believe, that one of the reasons why he quit drinking was because Laura threatened to leave and that he had been violent with her. He was certainly, you know, he threatened to beat up his own father. He bragged about it.
Well, I don't have any knowledge of these purported events. But
my question is, you know, the Democrats like never go there, and you guys go there in an instant. Is what you're doing coarsening politics,
or is what the Democrats are doing being stupid? On national radio that George Bush should have been executed. And
no, I didn't say that. What I said is that George Bush was AWOL, and that is a crime for which, at various times in the history of this country, the penalty has been death. And you know, George Washington used that.
Okay, well, I don't agree with your premise, which is that you know, the right is somehow you know, more willing to do you know, dastardly things than the left.
I'm not talking about dastardly things. I'm talking about character assassination, and which may or may not be legitimate.
Well, the claims against Kerry, as I said, were well documented. And the other piece of why they were effective, which goes back to your earlier question about politics, is because there was a deep current of underlying resentment among U.S. military veterans, particularly those from the Vietnam War, at Kerry for contributing to the environment in which they were seen as baby killers, war criminals, and you know, people that couldn't function in society.
Kerry never alleged that.
Pardon me? In fact,
the statement of his that you guys cherry-picked or that you guys used was only half the sentence. He said, I just came back from Detroit where vets are sane. And then he said that war crimes are happening. And you guys just quoted half a sentence and used that to engage in character assassination against him.
No, not at all. He was up there in front of the senators for an hour and a half.
I know, but that was the particular quote that got used over and over and over again in the media.
Here's another quote for you. He also said that the United States was murdering 200,000 people a year in Vietnam, which was completely ridiculous, and a character assassination of the U.S. military and the troops that fought there.
You don't. Okay, I don't have that statement in front of me, but I would submit to you that do you think that the United States is murdering anybody in Iraq?
Murdering anybody in Iraq?
Right.
Well, the United States is murdering people in every major city. I'm sure there are some crimes that are committed, and some of those are probably murder. Does that mean that, as Kerry stated...
Do you think that an illegal war that results in the death of people is murder?
Illegal war.
You think that Lyndon Johnson, when he knew that the Gulf of Tonkin was not real, and he lied to the American people, that everything that followed from that was not murder?
No, I don't think that's an accurate characterization. Both houses of Congress overwhelmingly approved the use of force in
Vietnam. Because they believe the information that the Johnson administration... I'm giving you an opportunity to attack a Democrat here.
Well, that was one aspect of why they voted on it. But, leaving a question aside of whether the Vietnam War was a good or bad thing, what Kerry said about the U.S. military was unforgivable to many veterans.
Okay. Scott Sweats, tosettherecordstraight.com, the website, also the title of the book. Scott, thanks for being with us today.
Okay, thanks for having me on.
16 minutes past the hour.
Well, I've heard that other countries are down on the U.S., a land of mass consumption, our lives filled with excess. But my daddy wasn't fighting on Normandy that day for the right to drive a Hyundai. I refuse to live that way. And I'm proud to be an American who gets just 5 mpg. Though I live alone, the car I own can seat 103, and I'll gladly park so close to you when you pull out you can't see. No, I'll never trade my Escalade. God bless my SUV.
So, character assassination. What's the nature of our political discourse here? And what can we do about it, frankly? I mean, you know, character assassination is frankly nothing new. In the election of 1800, John Adams had his buddies out there running articles in the newspapers about Thomas Jefferson sleeping with Sally Hemings. And it was true. I mean, we didn't find out until 200 years later, but it was true. But it was, you know, Jefferson was all in a harump about it. And Jefferson's people, Jefferson's front people, were running articles about how John Adams was secretly in the pocket of the British aristocracy and was, you know, an ultra-uber-conservative and had been trying to whip up fear with the XYZ affair and other things. And, you know, actually the XYZ affair stuff, that was true, too. It wasn't true that John Adams was in the pocket of the British, but, you know, politics was dirty. Politics has always been dirty. How do we clean it up? I think this is really the question for our day. Here we've had this 230-year experiment with politics, with democracy, with small-d democracy, in a constitutionally limited representative republic, a representative republic where we elect representatives, we elect people to represent us. We've had this experiment for a long time, and what we've seen is how well it can work in some regards. I mean, look at all the progress we've made. We ended slavery. Women got the right to vote. I don't want to say we gave. Women claimed. Women seized the right to vote. The progressive movement, we got the right for legal, I guess is the wrong word, but the right, the power, really would be the word, to form a labor union. And it's been under constant assault, but it's there. We got the regulation of some industries in ways that will prevent them from, you know, harming the United States and stop all the predators out there, or slow them down to some extent. Now, granted, over the last 26, 27 years, that's been going backwards ever since Reagan. Deregulation, obviously the cause of the whole savings and loan mess. But how do we clean up politics? We got this really, I think, frankly, kind of a cool system. How do we fix it? Let's talk about clean money for a minute. I just want to just toss this out. The Public Campaign, for example. One of the organizations, publiccampaign.org, there's a whole bunch of organizations out there that are working on this. But they point out that in Maine, let me just share some of these numbers with you. In Maine, 84% of the legislature, 84% of the legislature is represented by people who won using public funding. In Arizona, 42% of the legislature and 9 out of 11 statewide officials, including the governor, Janet Napolitano, ran her second race in 2006 as a publicly funded campaign. In North Carolina, two-thirds of the candidates running for the top judicial seats, 8 out of the 12, including 5 of the 6 winners, used that system. 5 out of the 6 winners. It actually helps. You know, people say, oh, he's the person using the clean money campaign. Must be a good guy. In New Jersey, in 2007, all 9 of New Jersey's winning legislative candidates in 3 districts where the state's fair and clean election system was available ran with public financing. all nine of the winners. In Albuquerque, New Mexico, 5 out of 9 eligible candidates used the system in the 2000, the first run for city election. This is in Albuquerque. You know, fair elections work. Publicly funded elections work. It's going to be a real challenge to get the money out of the campaigns because we would have to say things like, well, if you're going to run a Swift Boat campaign, that's considered a campaign contribution to the other guy. And so the, you know, that would have been a contribution to the Bush campaign. And so the Kerry campaign should have a similar contribution. And if it gets enormous amounts of publicity on television, hey, you know, that's a contribution as well. And how do you monetize that? Well, you consider the ad rate. And what about these, you know, 425s, 525s, whatever they are? What about these secondary groups that are pouring money right now into all the political campaigns? I mean, we're looking at a multi-billion dollar campaign year, 2008. It has exploded in large part since the Buckley versus Vallejo decision in 1976, the Supreme Court decision. But just cleaning up elections, this just seems like such a critically important thing. The way that they typically work, this is how it works here in Portland, it works in many other states, is if you get a certain threshold number of signatures and $5 contributions from people, then you get public funding of your campaign. And that public funding is matched when you get an opponent on, an opponent who's going to go up against you. It worked very well. Eric Sten, for example, worked very well here in Portland in the last election. Public, we really, I think, in order to stop or at least slow down the corruption of the process, why is it that our elected officials are so afraid to take on vested interests? Why is it that these kind of personal attack, destructive politics can run like this? Frankly, I think it's because there's so much money in the system. Let's take it out.
Like oil business, like no business I know. Everything about it is so thrilling. Buying up the Congress is just swell. Nowhere could you get that happy feeling like when you're drilling that Arctic well. There are no people like oil people. They smile when it does blow. Withholding technology, they know it well. OPEC strains a hold on the oil. They only care that their earnings do not fall, so their profits will grow.
Oh, no business like the oil business, and using that oil money to buy off Congress. You know, in the U.S. Senate, Dick Durbin, the Democrat from Illinois, and Arlen Specter, the Republican from Pennsylvania, introduced the Fair Elections Now Act, which would provide for full public funding for this for senatorial campaigns. There is expected to be a similar bill in the House. This is something that we really should be pushing for. Several of the candidates have pushed for this. John Edwards is speaking out loudly about it. Dennis Kucinich has talked about it. Chris Dodd has talked about it. As far as I know, Joe Biden has talked about it. These are, frankly, I think this is one of the major issues of our day, because our democratic process has become so corrupted. People don't, you know, people say, well, people ask, why don't people vote? Because they feel like their politicians have been bought off. And in many cases, they have. I get a note here from Dean in Seattle. He says, you ask why Dems don't use Swift Boat tactics. He says, it's simple. They don't have the guts to do what it takes to win. It's a fair part of the process. Character assassination. The Republicans are willing to do anything, including lie, cheat, and steal, while the Dems all want to play nice all the time. Nice guys finish last. The Dems keep proving it. He says, I wish it wasn't true, but it is. He says, I have this saying that I use since the Republicans stole the White House in 2000. Cheating is the new fair play. Well, see, Dean, you know, at a certain level, I agree with you, and I'm horrified by it. I mean, that's the thing. We need to clean up politics in the United States, and getting the big money out of it is a huge piece of it. You look at virtually all of the legislation. We had a contest back when we started this program in 2002. For the first, I don't know, 5 years or 4 years anyway, we had a regular contest on this show, and we probably ought to revive it. It was when the Republicans controlled the House and the Senate. And, in fact, the last politician I asked this question of was Tom Tancredo. He was on the show. This was maybe 3 years ago. And it was, please name one piece of legislation that has been signed into law by George W. Bush whose primary beneficiaries are human beings rather than corporations. Or are middle-class human beings rather than the very wealthy. And Tancredo, the only answer he could come up with was some piece of anti-abortion legislation, that it would save unborn life. And I said, you know, we'll agree to disagree on that. I'm talking about living, you know, people that we all agree are, you know, walking around breathing human beings. And got nothing. He had nothing. So I mean, this is, frankly, in my opinion, this is a big deal. It's something that we really need to be focusing on. You know, as a subset, obviously, to all the other things, but this is where the cancer is. The cancer is with the money. And frankly, a lot of this came out of this Buckley versus Vallejo decision in 1976 in the Supreme Court. That needs to be overturned. And yet you've got a guy in charge of the Supreme Court, John Roberts, who went down to Florida and helped teach the lawyers, coached them, because he used to be Rehnquist's clerk, coached them in how to argue before Rehnquist on the Supreme Court in the Bush v. Gore case, that if all the votes were counted in Florida, it would cause irreparable harm to the plaintiff, George W. Bush, which was what the Supreme Court ruled. That was their ruling, that if all the votes in Florida were counted, it would cause irreparable harm to George W. Bush, and therefore they stopped the counting of the votes. And you had John Roberts, who was down there teaching the lawyers how to argue before Rehnquist. What are the kind of things that Rehnquist likes to hear? What are the things that irritate him? What are the things that will get him, you know, get him happy and favorable to you? And he's now the head of the Supreme Court. And the next president is probably going to pick one or two or maybe even three more Supreme Court members, because we've got several members who are in their 70s and 80s. This is a critically important election. Now, obviously, we're not going to have campaign finance reform in time for this election, but let's ask our candidates, what's your position on this? Let's talk about some serious campaign finance reform, because frankly, I think most members of the House and Senate are as disgusted by all this as I am, and as you are, I know. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Richard in North Bergen, New Jersey. Hey, Richard, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. There's a couple things I wanted to point out. The guy was talking about the swift voting.
Yeah.
I mean, he was so full of it, it just made my blood boil, because he said there was no word processors back then. And that's a lie, because the Selectric came out in 61, 64, they added a tape system to it,
right.
And they actually called it a word processor back then. Xerox had a system in the 70s. A mag card. They had a mag card in 69, I think it was.
Yeah. So well, and beyond that, I mean, you know, beyond that, that whole debate was whether or not the documentary evidence supported the idea that Bush got into the service as a result of favors. It had nothing to do with the fact that he was AWOL for more than 30 days, which, under my understanding, the Uniform Code of Military Justice makes someone a deserter.
Yeah, that's true. The problem is,
and that was what I was talking about.
They all talked about, well, is it forged? It was never proven it wasn't forged, but the basic information was still correct.
Sure.
He did leave.
The guy who cut the deal on behalf of Bush Sr. testified on the record about it.
What the worst part was, though, he actually disobeyed a direct order to have a physical. That's a direct order. He didn't have the physical. They took him off of flight status. I have no idea what job he held. Because somebody described him going, you know, reading flight manuals after he was not a pilot anymore. So
right.
What job did they give him?
Well, and then he went down to Alabama or Louisiana, wherever it was.
He reported for duty in Alabama either.
Right. And the house that he rented was so badly trashed by him and his buddies that his family had to pay to basically have the entire house renovated. I mean, they literally ripped a chandelier out of the ceiling. It's but that was, you know, a good point. And that was my thing about, you know, the Democrats could have swift-booted George Bush. I mean, you talk about somebody who's ripe for the picking. That was low-hanging fruit. And they chose instead to talk about what they thought were the things that America cared about. And frankly, I would like to see campaigns like that. This whole swift-booting thing, frankly, disgusts me. On either side. Frankly, on either side. I mean, I'm seeing over on the Democratic side right now attempts to swift vote Democratic candidates. And it's just, it turns my stomach. I will not even go there on this program. I think it's absolutely so wrong. Amy in Rockville, Maryland. Hey, Amy, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I was just going to add that the CBS show with Ann Rathers stood, you know, the case they were making stood on its own without, you know, whether there were
processes
or not, it stood on its own without that.
Yeah, I agree with you. And again, it was about how Bush got into the military, not, you know, whether he got out. But again, that's, you know, it's like symptomatic of this much larger issue, frankly. So, Jeremy in Illinois. Hey, Jeremy, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Just great. What's up?
I have to agree with you on the campaign finance reform issue, but I don't think that we're going to actually achieve it through Congress unless we actually use some of the tactics that were learned about 4 years ago in the Dean campaign, where you can get a bunch of small donors en masse to donate $10 here, $20 there.
Well, that's sort of what's happening right now. I mean, on this program a couple of weeks ago, John Edwards pointed out that 94% of all the money that he's received has been under $200 contributions from individuals.
Well, I actually have a systematic plan to do something about it. I set up a website called congressionalrevolution.com, hoping to elect 100 new progressives to Congress and 20 new senators, which happens to be the number of Republicans running for the Senate next year.
Mm-hmm.
So, That's my plan.
That's great. And the website again, Jeremy?
Congressionalrevolution.com. Try and kick the bums out with a lot of small campaign contributions.
Okay.
My goal is
cool.
Get about a million people to donate small campaign.
Yeah, I know. I got it. You know, Act Blue is doing something similar, and MoveOn.org. There's others, but Congressionalrevolution.com. Write that down, David. We'll check it out during the break. Thank you very much. Robert in Los Angeles. Hey, Robert.
Yes, Tom?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, about the swift voting of Dan Rather?
Yes, sir.
Okay, the document obviously was written by Carl Rove.
Well, there's probably a good case to be made for that. Let's feed Dan Rather.
Here's the whole thing. What Carl Rove says is if some guy has a good point, he's going to turn that into a bad point.
That's right.
Okay, so here are the facts. The horrible thing was that they asked the secretary of the officer who wrote the original report, who's now dead, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. She testified that the document was clearly a forgery. But she said everything in the document was what the officer actually thought and wrote about the president.
Right.
Okay? So I'm telling some of my friends about the fact. And they're saying, yeah, but it's a forged document. And I said, yeah, I agree it's a forged document because the secretary confirmed it. And I said, but the secretary also confirmed that what the document says is really true. And
yeah.
They, you know what they say to that? Oh, she's probably a Democrat.
Yeah, I know. And I agree with you that it probably was Karl Rove behind it because it's absolutely consistent with the kind of things that he's done in campaigns forever. Michael in Virginia. Hey, Michael, thanks for the call.
Hello.
What's up? Hey, welcome.
Thanks. A little nervous. Excuse me.
It's okay. What's up?
Giving you a call, I'd listened and attentively to your conversation about the Swift veterans, and I guess a couple of points were brought up. And as I listen to you now, I can't agree more with the premise and agree with you on George Bush and where it is. And I was in the Army in 2003 when it went down, and it irritated me so bad. You know, I can remember arguing in chow halls, but how bad it was, and I thought it was legal, but some of the comments worry me that if I think ordinary people hear things like, you know, executable offense for the president being AWOL and whatnot.
No, I didn't say for AWOL, I said for desertion. Desertion is AWOL for more than 30 days. And
yeah,
and George Washington actually executed people for that.
Oh,
that was my point. But, you know, I take your point that I'm... Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. I hope you had a great Hanukkah, Merry Christmas, Happy Kwanzaa, and whatever else it may be. You know, Happy Solstice is coming. Is it the solstice or the... Yeah, it's the winter solstice is on its way. All kinds of celebrations. Happy holidays. Tom Hartman program, by the way, brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. And happy, isn't all the Hajj going on, too? Happy Hajj. Boy, there's a whole bunch of holidays. 866-303-2270. A.E. Barr drops me a note. He says, Tom, we're distinguished from Republicans not simply by calling ourselves Democrats, but by our actions. If we behaved like them, we would be them. We have won nothing and lost our Democratic identity if we behave like them. Amen. Dan in New York City. Hey, Dan, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. I'm calling. I agree with what you say totally. I was a Hillary supporter, but she made a comment recently where she said we need to move in the direction of publicly financed campaigns. And I thought that I was a little bit too soft on the stance that I wanted to hear. So I'm firmly behind Edwards now because I believe in his message. But one thing that does have me concerned is the swift voting of the current Congress and Pelosi with these low numbers. They're taking a general feeling about Congress and applying it all on Nancy Pelosi, even though right. She's made tremendous changes, and you never hear a word about it.
Yeah, the reality is Nancy Pelosi has gotten an enormous amount of stuff done in the House of Representatives. A lot of it has gotten jammed up in the Senate. It's gotten jammed up because Harry Reid hasn't been forcing filibusters by the Republicans. He's simply been letting them filibuster by a single sentence. And arguably, and, you know, Bernie has explained this a couple of times on the show, arguably, you know, Harry Reid has a logic behind that, and that is that he's actually trying to get some decent things done. He's stuck between a rock and a hard place. You know, it's the, you know, on the one hand, he can make the Republicans look bad. He could do that very effectively, but it would hurt the nation. And on the other hand, he can do what's right for the nation, but he can end up being the bad guy. And he's got an election coming up in 2010, and his numbers are in the tank, too. So what is Harry Reid to do? I mean, it's a real tough one, and you're absolutely right. The media is not helping at all because with a broad brush, they're painting Democrats along with Republicans. And, of course, that's because most of the corporate media in America is Republican. It's owned by people whose interests are served by the Republican Party. Dan, thank you very much. Well said. Steve, is it Venetia, California?
Yeah, it's Venetia, California. Tom.
Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, I just wanted to mention I'm really looking forward to seeing you on the upcoming cruise.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I'll be there for two or three days toward the end of it. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's terrific. I wanted to mention something about John Kerry that I hardly ever hear discussed. And he really went all out for Vietnam veterans after the war and established pushed a bill through Congress that established the Veterans Center for Combat Veterans. And it was specifically designed to help Vietnam veterans who couldn't readjust to life once they got back.
Well, and I would argue by his opposition to the war, he was the biggest supporter of veterans at the time of the war. I would say John Kerry has been the friend of veterans from the very beginning. He's one of the most honorable members of the United States Senate. I was pleased to proud to vote for him in 2004.
But when I hear... Yeah, so was I, and I sent money to his campaign. And when I hear Vietnam veterans are mad at Kerry, I just, they don't understand what a tremendous effort he's done to help try to save them, because the Veterans Center saved my life. I'm a combat veteran from Vietnam, and it was all I could do to cope with life until these people picked me up and...
Yeah. Well said, Steve. And I don't think that the majority of vets are upset with Kerry at all. If they were, he would not get reelected in his own state. This is, again, the swift voting continues. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Much appreciated. Michael in Long Beach, you wanna trash the Democrats here?
Oh, I don't want to trash it, but you know what? Why do you keep saying that the Democrats are above the fray?
I don't. In fact, I pointed out a few minutes ago that right at this moment as we speak, there are swift boat type attacks being used among the Democrats in the primary. And I think it's reprehensible. I think it's horrible.
But, Tom, you're bringing up this thing with Bush with the service. Gee, last time I checked, Clinton didn't serve in the military. Do you bring up Clinton's service record?
Clinton didn't serve in the military. That's very different from going AWOL.
Oh, AWOL. Oh, you know, do you have that documented that he was AWOL?
Well, he didn't show up for a year. What do you call that?
Oh, Tom, The point is that let's quit trashing each other, okay? What about the Democrats changing the subject?
I'm all in favor of that, Michael, and that's why, you know, I asked the question of the Swift Boat guy.
Yeah.
You know, if the Democrats had wanted to go after George Bush, how should they have done it? And it, you know, it was a semi-rhetorical question, I suppose. But, you know, I think that you're right. This is ancient history. And frankly, if I'm going to attack George Bush on something, I would much rather attack him on the fact that he just vetoed the state children's health insurance program, for example, and children will die in the United States as a consequence of his vetoing that piece of legislation.
Exactly. But the point is that Bush is not running. You know, he's past history.
You're right.
Let's concentrate on today. And when the Democrats bring up this thing with the dog being hung by Huckabee's son 10 years ago, you know why? Why is that such a big deal? Because Huckabee is in the lead.
I'm not sure that it's the Democrats that are bringing that up.
Who's bringing that up?
Well, it wouldn't surprise me if it was one of his opponents. I mean, the opposition research against Huckabee is being done primarily by the Romney and Giuliani campaigns, not by any Democrats. The Democrats are doing opposition research against their own candidates. And that's, again, and I agree with you, that, again, points to the problem with this system, which is why we need public financing of our elections. 57 minutes past the hour.
Now we have our own voice, and you have a place to activate your passion. The Valley's Progressive Talk, 1480 KDHX. This is the Tom Hartman Program, live and exclusively on the Valley's Progressive Talk, 1480 KPHX. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Tom Hartman, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Welcome back to the second hour of our program. There's a point that I would like to make that has rarely been made. I've heard a few CIA officers, I've heard a couple of people from the FBI, we've had law enforcement officers on this program who have made this point in the past, but it is absolutely not part of the national discussion on torture. And I want to focus this hour on it. And I'm speaking at a certain level from personal experience. I have not been tortured, but I have been in countries where torture is the norm. And I have been in countries where torture was the norm. I remember about 8 or 9 years ago sitting in Argentina, in Buenos Aires, Argentina. I wrote an article about this for Common Dreams back at the time. And I was sitting at I was staying with a middle-class family. And the wife and husband were, about my age. They were in their late 40s, early 50s. And they had a friend over, a woman who lived down the street and who just had come over for a cup of coffee, and she looked like just your average, absolute, normal, middle-class housewife. I mean, you know, right down to the Lucille Ball haircut. And we're sitting around the kitchen table in the kitchen in Buenos Aires, Argentina, and they were just making small talk. And I guess I brought the topic around. I frankly don't remember how it happened to, you know, what it was like during the bad times in Argentina. And this woman who was my hostess, who's the wife of the family that with whom I was staying, said about her friend who was sitting right there, "Oh, she was tortured." And I said, "You're kidding." And the woman said, "No." And then this woman told her story, and she told the story about how she had been arrested. She had been vanished. Her family didn't even know that she was arrested. She had been taken for several weeks in secret. She had been raped. They had put pins through her nipples and put electrodes on her. She had been beaten. She had been locked in solitary confinement for hours at a time, stripped naked. And this was just a normal middle-class housewife because she was suspected of participating with the opposition political party. And I got it. And they were telling me that the purpose of torture is not to extract information. It never has been. The purpose of torture wasn't to extract information in the 10th century. The purpose of torture. In fact, you go back to Roman times. There's an interesting entry about this over at Wikipedia. During Roman times, torture was only used after a conviction. The purpose of torture is to terrorize people. Torture is a form of terrorism. If you are in a country, and I have been in such countries, and you know, on the small scale, Egypt. I was in Egypt the week that Anwar Sadat was shot. People were scared to death. In large part, they didn't want to get arrested. Because, why? Because they knew they could be tortured. I was in Uganda during the war with Idi Amin when the Tanzanians came in and invaded the country in 79, 80, and 81. I was there in 80 and 81, at the tail end of the war in 1980 and afterwards in 81, during the presidential elections. And torture had been used extensively by Idi Amin. It was not used to extract information. It was used to scare the hell out of people. Torture is terrorism. That's the point we have to make over and over and over again. Torture does not derive good information. It doesn't. You absolutely do not get good information from torture. And here now we have this New York Times article. Bush's lawyers discussed the fate of the CIA tapes. And the original subhead said White House role was wider than it said. And the White House is calling on the New York Times to take down that subhead. I mean, this is incredible. And we find at least four top White House lawyers took part in discussions with the Central Intelligence Agency between 2003 and 2005. This is from the article by Mark Mazzetti and Scott Shane in today's New York Times, about whether to destroy videotapes showing the secret interrogations of two operatives of Al-Qaeda, according to current and former administration and intelligence officials. One former senior intelligence official with direct knowledge of the matter said there had been vigorous sentiment among some top White House officials to destroy the tapes. Now, why would they want to destroy these tapes? Because torture is terrorism. I mean, George Washington so had it right. John Adams so had it right. John Adams, the first conservative president of the United States, the second president of the United States, he wrote in a letter to his wife in 1777. Now, this is during the Revolutionary War. And he was talking about the techniques of war. He said, I know of no policy. God is my witness, but this piety, humanity, and honesty are the best policy. Blasphemy, cruelty, and villainy have prevailed and may again. And he was talking about the brutality that the British soldiers were using, the torture that the British soldiers were using against American prisoners of war. He said, but they won't prevail against America in this contest because I find the more they are employed, the less they succeed. In 1778, Colonel Charles Stuart, a British military leader, wrote to his father, the Earl of Brute. This is from an article by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. back in December 17, 2005 in the LA Times. Wrote to his father, the Earl of Brute, quote, wherever our armies have marched, this is the British, this is one of the British talking about their armies, about torture. Wherever our armies have marched, wherever they have encamped, every species of barbarity has been executed. We planted an irrevocable hatred wherever we went, which neither time nor measure will be able to eradicate. Now, on the other hand, George Washington said, this was after they captured 1,000 Hessians, 1,000 German mercenaries at the Battle of Trenton, most of whom later became good American citizens and are the ancestors probably of some of the people listening to this program right now. After Washington's men had captured 1,000 mercenaries, British mercenaries, I mean, working for the British. They were Hessians. They were Germans. He wrote, quote, treat them with humanity. Let them have no reason to complain of our copying the brutal example of the British Army in their treatment of our unfortunate brethren. Provide everything necessary for them on the road. George Washington got it that torture doesn't work. John Adams got it that torture doesn't work. The British, as they were fighting those nasty insurgents, the Americans in the Battle of 1777, they got it that torture doesn't work. Abu Zubaydah, this CIA toady who came out and was on national television a couple of days ago saying, oh, yeah, well, we got some good information from him once he got waterboarded. Turns out not the case. Dan Egan and Walter Pincus writing in the Washington Post yesterday. Just laying it out. Bush has sided publicly with the CIA's version of events. He says, we knew that Zubaydah had more information than that could save innocent lives, but he stopped talking, Bush said in September of 2006, and so the CIA used an alternative set of procedures. Right. But former FBI officials privy to details of the case continue to dispute the CIA's account of the effectiveness of the harsh measures, making the record of Abu Zubaydah's interrogation hard for outsiders to assess. There's little dispute that he provided valuable intelligence before CIA interrogators began to rough him up, including information that helped him identify Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, as well as Jose Padilla. But once they started torturing him, as he himself said, he said he would say anything to make it stop. The information became useless. They had basically already gotten everything he knew. FBI officials, I'm quoting again from the Washington Post, FBI officials, including agents who questioned him after his capture or reviewed documents seized from his home, have concluded that even though he knew some Al-Qaeda players, he provided interrogators with increasingly dubious information as the CIA's harsh treatment intensified in late 2002. Abu Zubaydah himself has asserted that he told his interrogators whatever they wanted to hear to make the treatment stop. Retired FBI agent Daniel Coleman, who led an examination of the documents after Zubaydah's capture in 2002, said the CIA's harsh tactics cast doubt on the credibility of the information. He says, I don't have any confidence in anything he says, because once you go down that road, everything you say is tainted. He was talking before they did that to him, but they didn't believe him. The problem is they didn't realize he really didn't know all that much. Torture is terrorism. So what does our Deputy Attorney General have to say about that, or at least the nominee for this? Ted Kennedy talking to him before the United States Senate. I will share that with you right after this break. 16 minutes past the hour. Past the hour. Tom Hartman program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199 fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. This is listener-supported talk radio, supported by you, our listeners, supporting our sponsors. Listen in particular for our sponsor, our local sponsors, and let them know that you're listening. It's the way that you can support our program, as well as our national sponsors. The ticking time bomb scenario, for example. Take the case, this was published in Prospect by Steve Cranshaw, Human Rights Watch director in London. He says, the ticking time bomb scenario can seem persuasive. He says, partly a question of the accuracy of statements under torture. Take the case of the Peruvian student Magdalena Monteza, abducted as an alleged subversive. After being tortured and repeatedly raped by her captors, she admitted to being part of a revolutionary cell. In the film State of Fear, she describes her story. I'd never had sex before. I was a virgin, 19 years old. I couldn't take the torture, so I decided to sign. I confessed to things I never did. If they had sentenced me to death, I wouldn't have cared. The Canadian-born Brit Bill Sampson was repeatedly tortured in a Saudi jail. Under torture, he admitted to being part of a network responsible for bombings and murder, thus enabling the authorities to pretend that there's no homegrown terrorism in Saudi Arabia. In the lead-up to the Iraq War in 2003, Colin Powell told a first-hand story. That's how Colin Powell described it, a first-hand story of how Saddam Hussein supported biological and chemical weapons training for al-Qaeda. This story was obtained from an al-Qaeda operative tortured in Egypt. It later proved to be untrue. As one CIA source said, this is the problem with using waterboarding. They get so desperate that they begin telling you what they think you want to hear. The simple answer is that torture does not work. It degrades the torturer. It degrades those who condone it. Acceptance of torture undermines the very foundations and thus the security of our society. In reality, the shameful use of torture has only helped plunge Iraq into an ever deeper instability. That Steve Crenshaw. When I say torture is a form of terrorism, I'm not talking about terrorizing the bad guys. I'm talking about terrorizing the good guys. As I experienced in that kitchen table, in that kitchen in Argentina, average citizens in that country were terrified. As I saw in Uganda, I saw it in Peru, I saw it in Colombia, I've seen it in Egypt, in countries all over the world. People who live in countries where torture is practiced, you don't have to torture everybody. You don't even have to frequently torture anybody. All you have to do is say, we reserve the right to torture anybody we want. And all of a sudden, the political opposition just kind of melts away. It's not the bad guys who are terrorized. It's the good guys. Torture is an instrument of state control over the good guys. It's a way of destroying democracy. So Mark Philip is testifying. He's going to be the number two guy behind under Mukasey. And he arguably correctly says he can't say whether waterboarding is torture or not because Mukasey is considering that. Mukasey is going to be his boss, and he has to make the decision. But then Ted Kennedy tries to pin him down on it.
And if I've had a view on it different from his, I would tell him so.
Well, you've been a judge. You know what this issue is. This shouldn't be something that's going to take a lot more study about it. I mean, you know what we're talking about. Not only you're familiar with the concept, but you know the arguments of it. You know what the debate's been about, and you know what the Geneva Convention. I mean, we ought to get repugnant is not, I think, the answer that meets the requirement in terms of the various statutes.
See, this guy had earlier said waterboarding is repugnant, and Kennedy's saying, wait a minute, isn't this a crime?
You're not prepared to tell us in your own words whether you believe that waterboarding is a torture. The same kind of techniques that the United States prosecuted Japanese for doing to Americans in World War II.
I think, Senator, that I ought to await having access to that information and await an opportunity, if confirmed, to give candid advice to the Attorney General on that before I answer a question he presently has under review.
Well, others will come, I'm sure, back to that. But I must say, everyone is familiar with the challenges that were out there for Mr. Mukasey when he refused to give an answer on that. And we thought that you'd be able to give a response to this. You've been a judge, made the decisions, know what the issues are. It's not a complicated issue and question on it.
Yeah, well,
and it seems to me that you ought to be able to respond to it.
Yeah, I agree with Senator Kennedy. But it is, although I would disagree with him on one thing. He says it's not a complicated issue. Well, waterboarding is torture. No, that's not complicated. It is torture. We have prosecuted people going all the way back to the Spanish-American War for waterboarding. Waterboarding was developed during the Inquisition and arguably even before that. We prosecuted the Japanese for doing it to our guys. The question is, if anybody in the Justice Department admits that waterboarding is torture, does that mean that George Bush, Dick Cheney, Don Rumsfeld, and Alberto Gonzalez then have to be prosecuted for violating both the Geneva Conventions and U.S. law? And the answer is yes. And that's why these guys are scared to death to go near it. 27 minutes past the hour.
It's all good. It's all right.
Minutes past the hour. Just a quick reminder, January 7th and 8th, I'll be in New Hampshire doing the show live from the Radio Row there, the Talk Radio News Service, for the primaries. And February 7th and 8th, we'll be at the Conservative Political Action Committee, or conference rather, CPAC, the American Conservative Union. This will be at the Omni Shoreham Hotel. So if you're in Washington, D.C., drop by and say hi if you'd like. If you'd like to say hi to me and 3,000 conservatives. It'll be a hoot. We love doing our show from the Conservative Political Action Conference. So anyhow, again, let me just make this point. It cannot be made enough because it is not being made by the corporate media. It's certainly not being made by the Republicans and the White House. And frankly, I don't think it's being made by the Democrats the way it should. And that is that the purpose of torture is not to get information. We've known since the Middle Ages. Even the Romans did not torture before a conviction. They did it after a conviction. Why? Because they wanted people to know that if they were convicted, they would be tortured. The scourging of Jesus is a great example. After the conviction, the torture, the whipping, the scourging. Actually, it was more than whipping. It was whipping with these things, with these god-awful things on the end of them. I mean, torture is a way of terrifying average people. They took apart Jose Padilla's personality. They gave this guy psychoactive drugs. We don't know what it was. It was probably LSD. They gave him drugs And they tortured him, and they put him in solitary confinement. We've had people who were locked, who were put in coffins, thinking that they were being buried alive, who were shipped in coffins, wondering if they were ever going to live again. I mean, the torture that this country has conducted, not just in the United States, with Jose Padilla, for example, one of our own citizens, but widespread in Iraq, the purpose of that, again, was not to get information. It was to terrify the average Iraqi into complacency. It didn't work. Just like the British torture of Americans in the 1770s didn't work. It just pissed us off. We got so angry. We got so upset. We said, that's it. We're not going to take it. We're not going to go along with this. And George Washington, on the other hand, said, not only do not torture, but when you take prisoners of war, treat them well. And they became some of our very best citizens after the Revolutionary War. Torture is terrorism. That's the mantra. Torture is terrorism. Its target is not the person being tortured. Its target is the civilian population who lives in fear that they might be arrested and tortured. 866-303-2270, our phone number. Jim in Flint, Michigan. You want to disagree with me, Jim, so you go to the front of the line. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I agree, you know, that the purpose of torturing is to terrorize us, but I specifically want to talk about the reasons behind why those CIA tapes of Zubaydah's torturing have been destroyed. We've heard the official reason, which is to protect the CIA's identity. Gerald Posner on the Huffington Post had another reason that he ventured, which was the information that Zubaydah provided during his torturing was that he gave specific details of intelligence officers in Saudi Arabia and Pakistan regarding the plan to attack 9/11 and the CIA's complicity with that. Yeah. And there was another diary up on Daily Kos that goes beyond and ventures an additional possibility, again, from intelligence officers, that Zubaydah was a key al-Qaeda figure in the CIA's Chechnya operation, which involved several of the 9/11 hijackers, and he was in a position to know about the relationship of the 9/11 Hamburg cell.
Yeah, Jim, first of all, I understand all that. First of all, Gerald Posner was the guy who wrote the book Case Closed, saying that Kennedy was killed by Oswald, end of discussion. I mean, Posner's credibility with me is at zero, absolutely zero. But beyond that, if we accept the idea that the reason that they destroyed these tapes was because they contained information that the CIA didn't want to make public, why didn't they destroy the transcripts?
Well, who knows if, you know, that's not what the fire in the Eisenhower executive office.
No, I'm serious. They are claiming that they still have the transcripts, they just don't have the tapes. I'm saying that they destroyed the tapes because if any senator or member of the House of Representatives ever saw those things, or for that matter, if any court ever saw those things, people's heads would roll. People would go to prison. These were documentary evidence of torture. And also, I do agree that it's entirely possible that those tapes were destroyed because they didn't want the information. And Jim, I'm sorry, your phone is feeding back at me really badly. I'm going to have to drop the call. But I will agree that one of the things that they didn't want to come out, and they're not letting out because the CIA is capable of keeping secrets, they're not releasing the transcripts of the torture of Zubaydah, that one of the things that they didn't want to come out was the information that he gave under torture, but not because it was good information, but because it was bad information. They didn't want us to realize, and this is what FBI agents are saying on the record right now, is that once they started torturing him, he started giving lousy information because they already had everything out of him that he had. And he just started making stuff up to get them to stop. And that's why they would want to destroy those tapes, in my opinion. Frank in Middletown, New York. Hey, Frank.
Hi. I guess my question is this. If the Attorney General, after some reasonable period of time, and I think he's had more than enough time, refuses to give an answer as to whether or not this is torture, when the Pentagon manual says it is, and we've, you know, for all the obvious reasons, does he become a co-conspirator? I mean, isn't there a point where his refusal to answer the question in itself becomes a crime?
Well, in the case of Mark Phillip, I don't think so, because he's basically...
I'm talking about the Attorney General himself.
Oh, Mukasey, yeah. With regard to Mukasey, I don't disagree with you. Yeah. Mark Phillip, the guy who testified the day before Kennedy's committee, I mean, he's going to become Mukasey's number two. He's going to have to work for the guy. And, you know, it would be like, you know, if you were applying for a job with me and somebody said to you, you know, if you disagree with Hartman, do you disagree with Hartman right now? And you say, well, I don't know. I'm trying to get a job from the guy. You know, I will tell him if I disagree with him. And that's what Mark Phillips said. And, you know, you kind of have to tip your hat to him for that. But
I wish Senator Kennedy had simply asked Mukasey, you know, when he's going to get an answer, like the January 20th, you know,
right.
You get this feeling that we're just, once again, like everything else administration does, drag this out until they can all get out of office and run to another country.
That's, or simply sit around very wealthy and lawyered up in this country, because we tend in the United States, and it's not probably just the United States, it's probably all over the world, we tend not to want to revisit the past, and we tend not to go after politicians once they're out of office, but rather to want to move ahead. And I predict that that's what's going to happen, that there are going to be very few prosecutions and probably none after the fact. And the terrible precedent was set, and thanks for the call, Frank, this terrible precedent was set by Gerald Ford in pardoning Richard Nixon. I mean, this was that was the original crime. You know, I'm reluctant to use the word crime and accuse Jerry Ford of being a criminal. That was the original mistake. Horrible, horrible mistake. And then it was added on to by Bush and Reagan, you know, with Ollie North and everybody else, and pardoning Caspar Weinberger and all these others. Anyway, Sue in Rockville, Maryland. Hey, Sue, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me on. I'm living proof that torture does not work. And the reason for that is that my parents are Holocaust survivors, and they were in the Lodz ghetto, and my father was in the resistance. He monitored radios. There were three radios throughout the ghetto, and many of his colleagues were captured. They were tortured before they were murdered by the Nazis. And none of them, as he always used to say, he's gone now, would say, none of them ever gave him up. They didn't give him up because torture doesn't work. It's to terrorize the people who were monitoring, you know, because, again, like, it's relevant to the media issue, which is suppressing any information, and they could control and keep them hopeless. But more importantly, these guys were tortured, and men and women, they gave up their lives. They did not give them the information they wanted. And I literally, me, my sisters, and all who have followed, none of us would be here if torture worked, because my dad would have been killed.
Right, because your ancestors were witnessing a crime against humanity, a genocide, and there was no way, if a country is engaged in genocide, there's no way somebody's going to say, oh yeah, I'll go along with you. Whereas on the other hand, there have been cases, like for example, when we captured World War II, German prisoners of war during World War II, and we treated them well. And they got it, that America wasn't the Satan that Hitler was making it out to be. And they realized the horrors of what they had committed. The German prisoners were singing like canaries, not with torture, with decent treatment, because they got it that they were on the wrong side of the thing. And your ancestors were on the right side, and they were saying, no, we're not. You know, very well said, Sue. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
I appreciate the comment. Well said. Bernice in Dearborn, Michigan. Hey, Bernice, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. A few weeks ago, I heard on the news about one of our own women officers in Iraq who had been commanded to perform torture.
Yes.
And it was so awful that she committed suicide. So we're not only torturing others, we're torturing the people, our own service people that we're commanding to torture.
We're dehumanizing them.
Absolutely.
You're right. It is, and the, you know, this this was one of the things that I saw in Uganda after the war and during the war. The civilian population was living in absolute terror of these soldiers, and many of these soldiers were 10-year-old kids. I mean, it was just incredible and spot on. It's when you start going down that road, when you start behaving inhumanely, and frankly, I think ultimately this is an argument against the death penalty as well, although that's a whole separate issue, but it all ties together. When you behave less than humanely, you make a world that is...
Would come carry me away, but I've been waiting here all day, and one just hasn't come my way. Now, excuse me if I'm not being reverent, but I was hoping for a miracle to hold me, wash me, save me from a righteous doubt as I watch helpless, and everybody sings, if it's Hanukkah or Kwanzaa, solstice, harvest, or December 25th. On earth to everyone and abundance to everyone. Your will,
welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-303-2270. We'll be back to your calls. And also, we're going to be talking about Hugo Chavez in the next hour with Bart Jones. But right now, Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service from Washington, D.C. is on the line with us. Hey, Ellen, welcome to the
program. Hi, I guess we'll start out with the fire at the White House. It was in the Vice President's ceremonial office, and actually there are several pieces in there that go back to the time of Lincoln. He almost never uses it except for ceremonies.
Now, did this fire begin when a shredding machine overheated?
Yeah, well, that's the joke going around the White House at this point, for sure. But they think it came from an electrical closet or something, and actually anybody who has been in the old executive office building, I guess it's now called the Eisenhower office building, knows that the wiring there and everything is just ages old.
Well, it goes back to the 20s, doesn't it, a lot of that wiring?
Whenever they wired it, it was built in the late 1800s, and then whenever they wired it a long time ago, initial wiring to make it electrical.
Yeah. So no harm, no damage. This wasn't like when the anthrax showed up in the Senate, and all of a sudden there were these guys in white suits going through all of Pat Leahy's papers.
No, nothing like that. No, they didn't permit the Democrat firefighters to go through the papers at all.
Okay. Yeah.
Other things that in the 14 years I have covered the White House, I've really never seen this. And Dana Perino in the office of the White House press secretary came out with a 3-page paper today refuting the White House story, saying that the White House mold was wider than it said.
You mean refuting the New York Times story?
That's right.
Yeah.
The New York Times said that the White House role was wider than it said, and it pointed out that Harriet Myers and Gonzo and all those other people were involved. But the White House has now said that they have not commented. They said they did not describe, neither to highlight nor minimize, the role of deliberations of the White House officials in this matter. And so, therefore, the White House is now saying that the New York Times, at least I'm hearing this, is probably going to retract the subheading. Because the White House is now saying no. They're not saying that these people weren't necessarily involved, but they said they did nothing to mislead anybody and then they released all of these various times, December 18th, December 12th, December 11th, December 10th, on how they said they would not comment on it.
Now, let me get this straight. The White House and the politicians and the political flacks thereof are protesting coverage in the news media.
They are protesting specifically the story, that's correct.
Right. During the Clinton administration, there was a fair amount of coverage of things that turned out to be incredibly absurd, Vince Foster's suicide, et cetera, et cetera. I just thought that was, like, part of the territory.
That's why I said that I have never seen in 14 years I've covered the White House, them going after a specific newspaper or news story with 3 pages refuting it.
Well, the reason that they're doing it is because that memo, which I got as well, is going out to all the right-wing talk show hosts in America, and you're going to hear a giant, we are right, I'm sure if anybody tunes around the dial right now, don't touch that dial, but if you were to, that's what you'd be hearing is, oh, we can't believe it. Look at this. The New York Times, they're biased. They don't have, it's a plot to get the Republicans over. Yeah, that's what they're doing.
You're missing an opportunity to be a stand-up comic.
Yeah, well, they're feeding the machine. That's what they're doing. This has nothing to do with really trying to set the record straight. They have the bully pulpit. They're just feeding the right-wing hate machine.
Well, yes, but I want to point out, again, just this is a very subtle difference, but normally when they're feeding the machine, it comes out of the RNC as talking points.
Right.
It does not come out as a statement by the press secretary that goes out to the regular White House press.
Is this going to be the new normal? What's his name? Cliff Kincaid, isn't it? Accuracy in Media, the right-wing group that particularly during the Clinton administration was all the time attacking liberal bias in the press, is the new right-wing anti-press bias organization going to be called the White House Press Office?
I have no idea, but that's a very good summation of what might be happening. I really think it's quite unbelievable in the way that they've dealt with it.
Well, I have to get Cliff Kincaid on the program and ask him if he's offended that his job is being stolen by Dana Perino. Actually, he's going to be on the program tomorrow, so I'll ask him.
Well, that's a good idea. Let me just run through one or two other things. The Fed is going to release $20 billion, I guess it's going to be on an auction basis, to help alleviate the world credit crisis. This is going to happen tomorrow. $20 billion, my friends.
$20 billion. You know, for you and me, that's a lot of money. For the world economy, it's a drop in the bucket.
No, but it could certainly help the banks here. And
yeah.
Also, the mortgage, subprime foreclosures, et cetera, gone up 68%. Compared to 1 year ago this month.
Right. I think that we are looking at the leading edge of a tidal wave. And
I agree with you, and particularly personal credit crisis is going to come after that.
Yep. It's because people have been using their homes as ATMs, and in part they've been using those ATMs to buy more things on credit, like big screen TVs and cars and whatnot, or frankly, health insurance and food. And when the ATM is gone, then the other debt that was associated and the credit card debt that was associated with it, that's going to go through the roof. And, you know, now that the credit card companies have been deregulated to the point where they can jack up interest rates simply because you're late on your home payment, it's going to spiral. It's a mess, Ellen. It's a mess.
A big mess. And this is, of course, the president who gave a talk on the economy just a day or so ago and saying how, you know, well, there's some storm clouds, but it's okay.
Yeah. Yeah, those storm clouds are like called Hurricane Katrina. I mean, it's, oh, man. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you.
Always great talking with you. 57 minutes past the hour. Everything you know is wrong, maybe. Let's find out about Hugo Chavez in the next hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the vast, radical, middle conspiracy. Accept no imitations. Tom Hartman.
Well, sometimes you know what you know, sometimes you know what you don't know, sometimes you don't know what you don't know, sometimes you don't know what you do know, and sometimes everything you know is wrong.
You know that you're wrong, but you fear you're right. You suspect you're out of sync.
You think that you're out of your mind.
Everything you know is wrong.
As the Firesign Theater so ably reminds us, perhaps, for example, the 22nd Amendment. To the United States Constitution, proposed on March 24th, 1947, when the Republicans took control of the House and Senate because they so hated Franklin Roosevelt, that would limit the term of the president to 2 years. It was ratified on February 27th, 1951. So it wasn't until 1951 that somebody couldn't serve as president for life, for example. Bart Jones is on the line with us. He's the author of the new book, Hugo! Or Hugo, as you'd say it in the anglicized way, I suppose. The Hugo Chavez story, from mud hut to perpetual revolution. Bart, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom.
Bart, I opened by mentioning the 22nd Amendment because the main meme that I was hearing in the corporate media in the United States was that this recent referendum that Chavez had put forward to the Venezuelan people would make him president for life. And basically what it did, among many, many other things, what it simply did away with presidential term limits, which we didn't have here in the United States for almost 200 years. And not only that, once the thing didn't pass, he said, okay, the people have spoken.
Well, you know, that's right, Tom. Chavez, you know, I think this is a perfect example of how we kind of hear one side of the story from the media regarding Hugo Chavez. He's been completely demonized. He's seen as this kind of evil monster. And, you know, everyone's got an opinion about this guy. You know, you would think we almost have a Pol Pot or a Hitler down there from the media accounts. And I think that's quite an exaggeration. So what I've tried to do in this book is really present a much more balanced and realistic portrait of Chavez. He certainly has his flaws, and I don't want to hold him up as a saint, but, you know, it's gotten out of hand. I think it's time for a reality check, really, about, you know, who is Hugo Chavez and what is he doing down there?
Yeah, well, my grandfather was a socialist. My father was a Republican. My grandfather loved Roosevelt. My father hated him. I mean, and Roosevelt, frankly, was characterized as you know, a tin pot dictator in his time. The story of Chavez, what did you do? How did you put this book together? How much time did you spend down in Venezuela? What brought this about?
Well, Tom, I lived in Venezuela for 8 years. So I was down there from 1992 to 2000, mainly as a foreign correspondent with the Associated Press. You know, Chavez's story, the reason I did the book partly is his story is really kind of straight out of Hollywood, and nobody's told it before, I don't think, in full. He was literally born in a mud hut in the Great Plains of Venezuela, later gets into the West Point of Venezuela because he is dreaming of becoming a Major League Baseball player, and the only way to get discovered by a scout would be being in the capital. So he goes into the West Point of Venezuela, and then shortly after he gets out, he begins a conspiracy within the military. And he creates a clandestine cell involving hundreds of other soldiers, which goes on for a decade, and eventually leads them to launch a coup against the government in Venezuela, which they feel was extremely repressive and was not addressing the issues of social injustice there. So that was kind of his early life. But the episode that really told me, you know, somebody's got to write a book about this guy, was a coup against...
Well, hang on just a second. He went to jail for that, did he not?
He went to jail for 2 years, that's right, and got out, spent a few years crisscrossing the country, and then by 1998 runs for president against a 6'1" blonde former Miss Universe. And he wins. And that was not an easy feat in Venezuela because it's the beauty queen capital of the world.
Hmm.
So his life, even up until he becomes president, is really just fascinating. Even if you hate the guy, you've got to recognize that he's had a pretty fascinating life. But the episode that really made me, you know, galvanized me into writing this book was the 2002 coup against Chavez. And what happened basically was on April 11th, 2002, hundreds of thousands of his opponents surrounded the presidential palace demanding that he resign.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, his supporters showed up to defend him and vowed they would defend him to the death. So clashes break out, violence breaks out, gunshots break out, and there's blood on the streets. It's a terrible situation. Later that night, using the violence as an excuse, military rebels overthrow Chavez, and they basically kidnap him for the next 2 days. They shuffle him from one secret location to the other, including a remote island off the coast of Venezuela.
And wasn't the plan to actually kill him?
Well, exactly. So he is kidnapped, and for 2 days the country doesn't know where the guy is. The president is missing, you know, and it's a complete news blackout, by the way. So his supporters take to the streets demanding that he be returned to the presidency. At the same time, loyalists in the military launch a counter coup. They commandeer some helicopters, fly out to this remote Caribbean island, snatch Chavez, bring him back to Caracas, and at 2:45 in the morning on a Sunday, this helicopter appears in the sky above the palace. All of his supporters are down there waiting. There's mist in the sky. The helicopter light is kind of flickering through the mist like something out of a Pink Floyd concert. The helicopter lands. Chavez gets out, and the people go crazy. They are, you know, hugging and kissing and dancing and in some cases fainting. And for them, it was as if Chavez had risen from the dead. They had feared that he was going to be killed during this coup, and by his account, he was indeed almost executed. So, you know, this kind of stuff you can't make up. It's just this amazing episode kind of straight out of Hollywood. And when that happened, I said, somebody's got to tell this story. And that's what I've done. I think for the first time really put together, you know, this dramatic narrative of Hugo Chavez's life and presidency.
We're talking with Bart Jones. He's the author of the new book, Hugo, the Hugo Chavez story from Mud Hut to Perpetual Revolution. Bart, the two stories, the two storylines that I think oversimplified storylines that we tend to hear in the United States are one, that Hugo Chavez is a great populist. He loves the people. He's a man of the people. He's trying to reinvent Venezuela as sort of a Sweden with oil, you know, a democratic socialist country that has, you know, that uses the oil for the good of people. And then on the other hand, you have people who say, well, you know, there was another guy, South American president, who wanted to be a professional baseball player. His name was Fidel Castro. And that Hugo Chavez is like Castro. He uses the rhetoric of populism and helping the people. And in fact, in some ways, he does help the people. But really, when you get right down to it, the guy's got an iron fist, and he throws people in prison who disagree with him, and he shuts down press that doesn't go along with him. And over time, you can expect him to get more and more repressive. And, you know, ultimately, he's, you know, Joe Stalin in drag. Those two kind of stark stories. It seems from reading your book that the reality is wildly in the middle.
Exactly, Tom. You know, both of these are really caricatures of Chavez, you know, these kind of cartoon characters of him. You know, and the one we've mainly heard, though, of course, is this image of him as another, you know, a Pol Pot, another Hitler, that type of thing.
Or at the very least, another Castro. That's the one he's most
compared to. Or at least another Castro. And, you know, I mean, to be fair, I think we've got to point out there are some real clear differences between Chavez and Castro. You know, they have real elections in Venezuela, fair and free elections, which he has won repeatedly.
And he just lost one.
And he just lost one.
And he went along with the will of the people. He said, okay, I lost.
That doesn't sound like a dictator to me. He lost a vote, a free and fair vote, and he accepted his defeat. So I don't think that's the type of thing that would happen in a normal dictatorship.
Yeah.
People by the thousands also take to the streets to protest against Chavez. I don't think that happens in Cuba. And the media is generally free. I mean, people go on television there and call Chavez a dictator and nothing really happens to them. So there are some clear differences between him and Castro. However, you know, he's not a choir boy either. I mean, he's a strong president. There are some concerns there. You know, eliminating those presidential term limits was of a concern to people. And, you know, it's not a perfect project down there either. They need to fight crime more. They need to fight corruption more. You know, they have some real issues they need to deal with. But both of these portraits of him, I think, are caricatures. I've tried to present a much more realistic portrait of Chavez based on fact, not on innuendo, and this kind of hysteria, I think, which has overtaken the debate on Hugo Chavez.
Yeah, we just have a few seconds, Bart. I'm curious. He's giving oil at a discount to people in the Northeast, or at least he did last year. Publicity stunt?
Well, a little bit of both. And, you know, I did interview Chavez for the book. I spoke about things like that with him when I interviewed him twice earlier this year. You know, certainly there's a publicity angle to that. It allows him to stick his thumb in the nose of the Bush administration, which, by the way, supported that 2002 coup against him. But, you know, you could also argue he's got a genuine interest in helping the underprivileged.
Yeah, and it appears that much of his life has been devoted to that, his having come from that past. So neither saint nor sinner.
That's right.
Hugo, the Hugo Chavez story from Mud Hut to Perpetual Revolution is the book. Bart Jones is the author. It's a fascinating read. Highly recommended. Bart, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
16 minutes past the hour.
And I wonder, yes, I wonder.
Minutes past the hour. Well, this is interesting. The Center for American Progress has compiled some statistics here pointing out what Al Gore has been saying, that the severity of the climate crisis. Well, this is a quote from Al Gore. He says, "We, the human species, are confronting a planetary emergency, a threat to the survival of our civilization that is gathering ominous and destructive potential." And then they ask, you know, how many times have the media, particularly the pontificators, those who are asking questions of politicians, How many times have they mentioned global warming? NBC's Tim Russert, in the past year, he has asked 664 questions. How many have mentioned global warming? Zero. Wolf Blitzer, 331 questions. How many have mentioned global warming? One. George Stephanopoulos with ABC. He's asked 661 questions of politicians. How many have mentioned global warming? Zero. CBS's Bob Schieffer, 212 questions. How many have mentioned global warming? Zero. Fox's Chris Wallace. Fox News comes out ahead. He has asked 427 questions. How many mentioned global warming? Two. Amazing. And you know, Chris Wallace's questions, of course, are things like this. He asked Chris Dodd, you know, the Democrat from Connecticut who was on our program yesterday. He says, let's turn to domestic policy where your big issue is energy independence and also fighting global warming. Wouldn't a carbon tax put a real drag on the economy? And that's how he asked about global warming. That's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. Mary Matlin is talking about publishing Rove's memoir. Say what? GOP strategist Mary Matlin? Yeah. Just a quick overview of some of the things going on. The top four White House, courtesy of ThinkProgress.org and the Center for American Progress, top four White House lawyers, Harriet Myers, John Bellinger, Alberto Gonzalez, and David Addington. This is from the New York Times, quote, took part in discussions with the CIA between 2003 and 2005 about whether to destroy videotapes showing the secret interrogations. Some White House officials reportedly voiced vigorous sentiment in favor of the destruction. That, you know, revisiting our second hour. Here's another note. Iraqis of all sectarian and ethnic groups believe that the U.S. military invasion is the primary root of the violent differences among them. This is from today's Washington Post. And they see the departure of the occupying forces, in quotes, as the key to national reconciliation, according to focus groups conducted for the U.S. military last month. Did you notice last night, if you saw Chris Matthews yesterday, interviewed John Edwards, he kept asking him about the war in Iraq, and Edwards kept talking about the occupation of Iraq? Good on you, John Edwards, for that. Despite significant security gains in much of Iraq, nothing has changed within Iraqi's political leadership. The Iraqi government has made little headway, this is a quote from the New York Times, in improving the delivery of electricity, health care, and other essential services. Maybe that's because instead of giving our money to the Iraqi government so they can do these things, we're giving our money to Bechtel and Halliburton and KBR, and kind of ends up in their CEOs' pockets and their stockholders as dividends. Remember Bud Cummings, the ousted U.S. attorney? He has called on the Justice Department's communications director, Brian Rorcassi, to step down, contending that he, quote, did more than perhaps any other DOJ official to disseminate the avalanche of untruths in the U.S. attorney scandal. Interesting. And Vlad Putin, the man of the year, well, person of the year, taking a country that was in chaos and bringing it to stability. This is fascinating. A few months ago, I was in Germany for the 50th anniversary of this international charity that I've worked with for almost 30 years, Kinder und Jugendhilfswerk Salem in Schottsteinach. SalemInternational.org is their website. And we have a program in Russia, which I helped start. I write about it in a book of mine called Prophet's Way. And I was there at the birth of it. And this was right after the fall of the Soviet Union. And spent, you know, not a lot of time there, but a fair amount of time there. This was before Vladimir Putin. In fact, I was in Russia during the elections when Vladimir Zhirinovsky was running, the extreme right-wing candidate. He was sort of the Pat Buchanan of Russia. And I remember sitting in the home of a Russian family. The wife was German-Russian. She spoke German, and the husband only spoke Russian. This was in the Kaliningrad area, which has gone back and forth. It used to be called Königsberg when it was part of Russia, part of Germany. Now it's called Kaliningrad. And this guy comes on TV, and he's pounding his fist on the table, and you know, he's doing this, like, demagogue routine, and she starts laughing. And then they flip to the two commentators, the housewife next to me. She starts laughing, and they flip to the two commentators on TV who are having this very serious discussion. I said, what's going on? And she said, and she tells me in German, she says, he just said in Russian, he just said to the audience, and this was live Russian television. Everybody in Russia could see it. It was live, you know, the one channel. He just said that anybody who votes for him, and this was the day of the elections when the polls were open, he just said anybody who votes for him is going to get a turkey or a chicken, I forget which it was, and a pint of vodka, or a liter of vodka. And now they're trying to figure out, where is he going to get all the chickens or the turkeys? Amazing. 27 minutes past the hour.
Nothing and nothing leads to wisdom. It's like no one really meant what they meant. It's like every man's a king, every house a kingdom. It's like Joe McCarthy was our acting president. Everything's A-OK in the USA, in the good old USA. Everything's A-OK.
34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. And this from, as we like to say, the wire services. The headline, Clinton says being married to Hillary has never influenced my behavior. Addressing questions about his objectivity as a campaigner for his wife, Senator Hillary Clinton, former President Bill Clinton said today that being married to Senator Clinton, quote, has never influenced my behavior in the least little bit, end quote. I guess I don't do a very good Clinton imitation. Anyhow, during an interview on PBS's The Charlie Rose Show, the former president said that those who accuse him of favoritism toward his wife have got it all wrong because, you know, Charlie, I've pretty much lived my entire life as if I wasn't married to her at all, end quote. Mr. Clinton added that in order to demonstrate his objectivity during Senator Clinton's qualifications, he would remove his wedding ring and keep it off for the duration of the campaign. As far as I'm concerned, from this day on, I'm single, the former president said. During the freewheeling one-hour chat, aides to Mr. Clinton gathered in the studio control room and frantically attempted to induce the engineers to cut short the interview, with one aide trying to pull a cable out of his socket in hopes it would plunge the studio into darkness. But their efforts were in vain as the former president continued his unbridled monologue, at one point touching on the similarities between a president and a prostitute. Being a president is a lot like being a $1,000 a night call girl, Charlie, he said. Experience matters. Yeah. This actually from Andy Borowitz, the comedian, from with permission from the Borowitz Report, borowitzreport.com. It's funny how, I think I'll just leave it at that. Marcus in Orange County, California. Hey, Marcus, thanks for calling the program. What's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. I just wanted to relate something. When I was in the Air Force in the early 80s, they asked us at our base to watch a movie with Charles Bronson called The Evil That Men Do. And it was regarding a doctor who was involved in torture under a right-wing government and these juntas and what they did to these people down there in South Central and South America. First of all, I recommend every one of your listeners to get a chance to go see this movie if they can get it. It's called The Evil That Men Do with Charles Bronson. And don't eat and be prepared to cry. And all I can say is the Air Force that I served in, the United States that I took a constitutional, you know, pledge to defend, never, never, never advocated torture. We were absolutely adamant against it. We were a nation that stood above this. We were the beacon of the world. And now we have a president that signs into legislation the very concept of using torture as a ways and means of obtaining information. I am telling you, I never thought I'd live to see this day. I'm a nine-generational person who served nine generations of my family in the United States Armed Forces, and this is absolutely reprehensible.
Very well said, Marcus. Thank you. Thank you very much for your call and for your service to our country. Very, very well said. I have a note here from Dean in Seattle. He says, I'm a former Marine, and I pulled out my old Marine Corps manual because I knew there was a chapter on the treatment of prisoners. This is chapter one of the manual. The chapter is quite specific about the fair and decent treatment of prisoners and states that violating these standards is a criminal act. It also is specific in that if you witness the cruel treatment of prisoners, you are to take immediate action to stop it and or report it to superiors. 1-866-303-2270, Jackie in Seal Beach, California. Hey, Jackie.
This is Jackie?
Yes, and you are on the
air. Oh, well, I couldn't hear you that well. Well, I called to set the record straight about this Van Rather memo. These Swift Boat guys have based their biggest argument on the fact that they say it's a forgery.
Right.
Because they didn't have word processors in those days. Well, that part of it's true. They didn't have word processors. But they did have IBM executive typewriters that did do proportional spacing. I typed one back in the 50s, typed on one in the 50s, and I bought a secondhand one in the 70s. And so it could have easily been done on an executive typewriter, which were very popular in those days.
Thank you, Jackie. Thank you. And I, ultimately, in my mind, it doesn't much matter because the documents were only backing up the actual testimony of the actual guy who, on behalf of George Bush Sr., who was then a member of Congress, got his son into the Champaign unit of the Texas Air Force National Guard, the air wing of the National Guard, and then Bush went AWOL. And then after 31 days of being AWOL, he became a deserter. And, I mean, you know, the story is still there. It's still real. But as one of our callers said earlier, we really need to be talking not so much about, and frankly, I agree with it, not so much about Bush's character as about his actions. And his actions, you could argue, derive from his character. But as the caller said a few minutes ago, I never thought that I would see this country come to this. I don't think most of us did. It was, anyhow, Jim in Oregon. Hey, Jim.
Good morning, or good afternoon to some.
Yeah, well, it's 11:40 in the morning here on the Pacific Coast. It's 2:40 in the afternoon on the East Coast and all places in between, so I guess you got both.
Yeah, well, I've called in before and talked to you, and you're quite a reasonable individual. I just wanted to say that I was military. I was a combat crewman in the Air Force and went through survival training. With a mock POW camp, and we went through extensive training on torture techniques. And let me tell you, people don't stress how much. You talk about stress positions. It doesn't take much of a stress position over a long period of time to turn somebody into just a blithering idiot.
Sure.
I honestly believe this, it would be a lot easier for our government to get information from people if they put them up in a four-star hotel and treat them right.
Well, frankly, most of the interrogation techniques that are successful involve creating the Stockholm Syndrome. They involve getting the person that you've detained to identify with you and build a relationship with you, and you get really good, high-quality information and cooperation over the long term.
I agree on a lot of levels there. I think that there's... You know, there's still POWs or there's MIAs from Vietnam that have never showed up. You know, a lot of those people, I think they're still over there. I think a lot of that happened where they just started identifying with the culture and bought into it to the point where they decided to stay.
Yeah. I can't speak to that, but I can tell you that it was one of the big problems of the early colonists in the 1600s here in North America, colonists from Europe, what they call white Indians, which was Europeans who would go out and live with the Indians and just never come back. They just never came back. And Jefferson wrote about it at some length in his Notes on Virginia. And you know, it's among other things.
I'd just like to end by saying that even when I was in, the concept of torture was completely counterproductive, and it was proved beyond a shadow of a doubt, even then, that you can make someone say anything you want.
Yeah, and your training in it, I assume, was to know how to withstand it, not how to inflict it.
You know, more or less, just to be aware of it.
Yeah, this is what it is. Yep, Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Much appreciated. Oh, my. Mark in Laney, New Mexico. Hey, Mark, listening on KTRC.
You seem to be an intelligent man, and what do you think about the fact that just when the big shoe is about to drop on Dick Cheney, his entire office building catches fire this morning?
Yeah. That's why I said, you know, is it because the shredding machine overheated? I don't know. Mark, it's the joke going around in Washington, D.C., but the fact of the matter is, you know, I mean, destroying the torture tapes, over 5 million missing emails. We don't know how many of these have to do with that seem to have to do with the so-called prosecutor scandal, the U.S. attorney scandal. As I said, I've been saying for years now, I believe that the attorneys, Don Siegelman's case down in Alabama that we've talked about on this program many times, the biggest case in point, the attorneys that we need to be looking at are not the ones who were fired. They're the ones who stayed. And what's the deal with these 5 million missing emails that had to do with the attorney scandal? Was it the politicization? I can never say that word right. of our justice system. And that's a crime against America. I mean, the crimes against America that this country has committed are just absolutely mind-boggling. Chris in Carson, California. Hey, Chris, what's on your mind today?
Good morning, Tom. Revisiting Hugo Chavez, there's a documentary called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. You go on Google or YouTube and watch that documentary and see what happened as it happened. There was a Dutch film crew that happened to be there filming Hugo Chavez when that coup sponsored by the U.S., took place. I believe that they went after him because he had the temerity to nationalize his oil.
Right.
And he took the land back from the wealthy and redistributed it amongst the poor.
Oh, it was a coup of the elites.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And, if I could revisit the first hour also, you were talking about politicians and campaign finance reform. And I just want to let you know that I get that every politician that runs for office, that's running for office, has to file a campaign contribution form.
Right, disclosure form.
Yes, and you can go to your clerk's office in any city in America, and that clerk has a copy of that form. It's public record.
Right, and there are some websites. I don't have the names of them at the tip of my fingers, but that aggregate that.
But
yeah,
that's how you can put these guys in check and find out. And I've actually peppered politicians running for office with the information of who contributed to his campaign.
Good on you, Chris. Now, the one problem is that if they're contributing to a third-party organization, like Huckabee apparently has somebody running push polls for him in New Hampshire. Well, it's not him, so he says, well, it's not me. 45 minutes past the hour. Dennis Kucinich's younger brother has died, it looks like of natural causes, but our sympathies go out, assuming that these news reports are accurate, to Dennis and his wife and his family. 1-866-303-2270, your telephone number. Eric in Alaska. Hey, Eric, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's up?
Well, good to hear. Just listening this morning, as I always do, and wanted to put a sentiment out there, more of a kind of a personal feeling sentiment about the direction of the country and what's happened. This is not the country I grew up in. I know that sounds dramatic and grandiose, but it really isn't. Never did I think that we would ever get to a point where we're even having public debates on the merits of torture.
Right.
The Don Siegelman situation, we have political prisoners in our country now. And the one thing that's really affecting me and it's become very personalized, is the complacency of the average American and how it almost seems like they're rolling over to allow this to happen. And I think back to that quote, I forget the person who said it, but it was from World War II, you know, when they came to round up the gypsies, no one said anything because they were just the gypsies. And then when
Pastor Niemöller. Yeah.
Right, right. Well, it seems like that's kind of happening in a sense here in this country, because we're very placated with satellite TV and everything else, and yet we look around and there are these atrocities taking place on American soil that I never thought would happen. And that's why I say the country that I'm living in now is not the country I grew up in.
Yeah.
And how do we get those complacent people aware? How do we start to make the tide change that is necessary?
We have to speak out. I mean, it's really that simple. Milton Mayer, in his book They Thought They Were Free, went back to Germany after World War II and interviewed 10 good Germans, I mean, just average Germans, and who didn't, you know, participate in any atrocities, but also didn't speak out against them. They just did their jobs throughout the whole Reich. And one of them said, You have to understand, this happened gradually enough. You know, we were all waiting for the next big event that was going to put a million people in the streets, and it never came. You didn't go from A to D. You went from A to B, and from B to C, and from C to D, and every one of those seemed like a small step. And he said, ultimately, what happened was the form was there. You know, the holidays, the towns, the stores were open. The forms were all there, but the spirit was gone. And that's what it sounds like what you're saying.
Exactly. And I think of also kind of to speak in metaphor, the case of a frog. When you put a frog in water, room temperature, and slowly begin to heat the temperature of the water up, the frog will sit in that water until it's boiled to death.
Right. It'll fall asleep first, yeah. But, yeah.
But you know, if you toss a living frog into boiling water, and I'm not advocating that to any of the listeners.
Right.
If you toss a frog... Exactly. And it seems like, you know, I want to just scream at the top of my lungs saying, folks, the water's beginning to boil.
Yeah, it is. And Eric, you just did, and thank you very much. And that's hopefully the message of this program on an ongoing basis as well. Thank you, Eric. Christy in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Christy.
Hi, Tom. My uncle was Private Eddie Slovak.
That name sounds very familiar.
The Execution of Private Slovak was a book. It was a movie starring Martin Sheen.
World War II, right?
World War II. He was executed on Eisenhower's orders for desertion. There were thousands of American soldiers who deserted. He was the only one who was executed. You mentioned that Washington had soldiers executed for desertion.
Yeah, half a brigade, actually, about 1,000 men.
Okay, well, he was the only American soldier executed for desertion during World War II.
Interesting. And this apropos of my comment that George Bush, when he was gone AWOL for more than 30 days during time of war, that was a desertion.
That was desertion.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, Christy, thank you for the insight into history and for your call, and thanks for listening to us there in Ann Arbor. Let's see here. Cy in Ohio, you've been on hold for quite a while. Cy, my apologies. What's up?
Hi. Is that a vegetarian charity?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you're talking, yeah.
They've done wonderful work in the U.S. as well.
Yeah, the Louise and I started the Community for Abused Kids in New Hampshire in 1978, and then Louise Richard started one in Maryland in 77, or in early 78. And then out of that, we also started the Hunter's School, and they all use a natural foods, vegetarian natural foods diet as part of their therapy.
That brings up my point about the candidates and the animals. Huckabee's son hanged a dog in camp, and Huckabee has mechanized poultry slaughter for Tyson's in Arkansas, as did Hillary and Bill Clinton.
Yeah, my understanding, though, about the Huckabee thing is not so much that people are outraged that his son, you know, hanged a dog and slit its throat, and he's now trying to say his son was trying to euthanize it or something like that, but that at the time, apparently, there was a big cover-up around it. You know, again, I don't pretend to be an expert on that issue. I'm just reading the news reports and the blogs and things. But the way that we treat animals as a society is ultimately, I think, a reflection of the way that we treat humans and the way that we think of ourselves.
And Romney as well, his dog Seamus on top of the car for 10 hours and his investment of Bain Capital in cattle concentration camps.
Yeah, Bain Capital, the company that will soon be my employer, I think, here. Anyway, thank you, Cy, for the call. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman Program, Cliff Kincaid and I will debate if Michael Savage's anti-Muslim statements should be considered hate speech or First Amendment free speech. Naomi Klein is here, one of my favorite authors on Guns Beat Green, The Market Has Spoken, and Christy Harvey from the Center for American Progress at News Below the Radar. Don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Taking back America begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.